Thanks to each of you for coming here this morning. At this time, I want to give a brief introduction for each candidate. The incumbent and Democratic candidate for this position is Congressman Brian Higgins. Congressman Higgins is a graduate of South Park High School, has a bachelor's degree in political science from the State University College at Buffalo, and a graduate degree from Harvard's distinguished John F. Kennedy School of Government and Public Policy and Administration. Congressman Higgins began his political career by serving 3 terms as a member of the Buffalo Common Council and 3 terms as a New York State Assemblyman. Congressman Higgins is currently in his 5th term as a member of the House of Representatives. By the way, a term for the member of the House is 2 years. He is in his 5th term. Mr. Higgins is married and has 3 children. Two children. Thank you.
That's okay.
I didn't mean to scare you.
No, okay.
The Republican candidate for this position is Mrs. Kathy Wepner. Mrs. Wepner graduated from the former Bishop Newman High School and attended St. Bonaventure and the University at Buffalo. After college, she worked at Channel 7 in the newsroom as a producer and editor. She eventually left Channel 7 to have a family. Most recently, she hosted her own talk show on WBEN. Mrs. Wepner is married and has 5 children, I hope.
6 now.
6 children. All right.
We added a son, so.
I think she picked up Mr. Higgins' child that he never had.
Yes, we picked up his extra.
The rules for the debate are as follows. Each candidate will begin with a 1.5-minute opening statement. There will be no rebuttal to the opening. Next, each candidate will be given a question from the moderator and will be given 1.5 minutes to respond with no rebuttal. A panel of students from the American government class will ask a number of direct questions. The candidates will be given 1 minute and 15 seconds to respond, and the rebuttal will be 45 seconds. Finally, each candidate will end the debate with a 2.5-minute closing statement and no rebuttal. The moderator reserves the right to ask a follow-up to any of the direct questions that are asked. Very briefly, I want to introduce some of the participants this morning. Our panel from the AP and American Government classes are Tyler Daly, Andrew Diet, Ryan O'Lair, and Dominic Tioli. Our timekeeper is Charles Paglione. Our fact checkers are Lucas Olesko, Patrick Judge, Bobby Simon, and Canio Morasco. I would especially like to thank Mr. Pat McHale from the St. Joe's History Department, who has worked on debates for many years with me, and also Mr. Scott Mueller from the St. Joe's History Department that began working with us last year. Both of these men have worked several hours after school and the students on questions that will be asked here this morning. Now, based on a coin toss conducted earlier, Mrs. Wepner will begin with her opening statement, followed by Congressman Higgins, and Mrs. Wepner will also go first in regard to the closing statement, followed by Mr. Higgins. Thank you, and let's begin the debate with you, Mrs. Wepner.
It was about 34 years ago that my parents came here to St. Joe's because they wanted a great education for their son, my brother, who had been born deaf. And St. Joe's had never accepted a student with a disability. And Brother Dominic said, yes, we can. We will do that. And it is so Catholic to do that. We step out of our box and we help whenever we can. My brother John graduated from St. Joe's, and my brother Michael, who's here today, graduated from St. Joe's. And subsequently, my oldest son in 2003, and my youngest, who's here, in 2013, a decade later. You are blessed with going forward into this world with a Catholic education, not only the ability to be the movers and shakers of the future, but the problem solvers. I'm running for Congress because we have very big challenges ahead of us. We have a structural problem in the United States with our debt and with the economy. If we don't fix these problems now, there's not going to be a lot left for you. And last year, we did add $800 billion more dollars to bring us almost to $18 trillion of debt. That debt will be on your shoulders if we don't fix it. And nobody seems to even be talking about it. So that is why I'm running. I have not run for office before. And I think a lot of our very smartest are actually in Washington now. And they've made a mess of things. Our founding fathers did make it so that every 2 years, if there was ever a time of great corruption, the entire House of Representatives could all be replaced at one time, and I think we are there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Wepner. Next, Congressman Higgins.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here at St. Joe's. I gave the graduation speech a couple of years ago. It's good to be with you again. I asked this community 10 years ago to send me to Congress, not to become a social member of Congress, not to move away to Washington to become immersed in that culture, but to find a way to help revitalize this community. I was a freshman member in the minority, and I took on the New York Power Authority that was seeking a new 50-year license to own and operate the New York Power Authority, an Niagara Power Project in our community. We won a $279 million settlement, which is now financing the redevelopment of Buffalo's waterfront. New parkways, new parks, new places for economic development. Canalside, a place along downtown's waterfront 6 years ago desolate. This year we had over 1 million visitors and over 900 events. Private sector investment surrounding the area today is unprecedented. The Economist magazine, the New York Times, the Boston Globe, the Baltimore Sun, in the last 6 months have done feature stories on the city of Buffalo, calling it once the brunt of jokes, now a place teeming with energy, with optimism, with hope for a better future. I will continue to fight for Buffalo and Western New York so long as I'm a member of the United States
Thank
Congress.
You, Congressman Higgins. Our first question to each candidate will come from me, and each candidate will be given 1.5 minutes to respond with no rebuttal. After a steady decline over the past 2 decades, school violence has seen a rise over the past 2 years, with nearly 750,000 violent victimizations in 2012 alone, according to data from the National Center for Education Statistics. Most recently, a shooting in a Seattle area high school left 3 dead and 3 injured. Mass killings such as this and the one at Sandy Hook Elementary School in 2012 have provoked calls for wildly varying responses, from stricter gun access laws to arming teachers and administrators. Some schools have already begun training teachers to carry in the classroom. What policy do you advocate to keep our students safe from such horrific crimes? Mrs. Wepner.
Bad guys will always be able to get guns. I carry every day. I'm a good guy. I'm not carrying now because I'm in a school. But I would never hurt anyone. But if you were lucky enough to be in a room with me and somebody really bad did come in, I might be able to do something about that. We cannot. Per our Constitution, and I brought constitutions for everyone today, per our Constitution, we cannot take the right away for a good guy to carry a gun, because good guys aren't going to do anything bad with them. Schools are gun-free zones, aren't they? So if a bad guy came in, I wouldn't be able to do anything here today. That's not a great idea, because bad guys will pick places where people can't shoot back. So I believe strongly in the Second Amendment, because bad people will be able to hurt people with hatchets in the middle of the street in New York City. Bad people will be able to stab people with knives. Bad people do bad things. And we just had a beheading in Oklahoma, and the CEO of that company had a firearm on him, and he ran towards the screaming because he knew he would be able to do something about whatever was happening. And he was able to prevent the second beheading in his company that day. Had his office been a little closer, maybe he would have been able to stop the first one. So I believe strongly in good people being able to carry firearms because they can stop bad people.
Thank you, Mrs. Wepner. Congressman Higgins.
I, too, believe that good people should be allowed to extend their right to carry firearms. But I think the framers of the Constitution and the Second Amendment, when you consider the gun violence that's occurred in this country over the last several years, Sandy Hook being just one, they could not have anticipated this kind of hell. And they would have provided for flexibility to ensure that guns don't end up in the hands of bad people. So if you support the right to bear arms, which I do, what's wrong with reasonable background checks? Just to ensure that those arms don't fall in the hands of bad people. So that the only people that will be carrying guns are those who are good people. And law enforcement officers to make sure that they're safe and to make sure schools are safe and communities are safe. So I believe that reasonable gun control can be accomplished by reasonable people without infringing on the rights of those gun owners.
Thank you. Our first direct question will go to Mrs. Wepner.
Mrs. Wepner, for several weeks you have been running on a campaign commercial on WBEN stating that Mr. Higgins will not agree to a public debate. On that same station, you claim that the St. Joe's debate does not count because it is not open to the public. Isn't this somewhat disingenuous when, in fact, several weeks ago, Congressman Higgins agreed to debate you at St. Joe's, and this debate is open to the print and broadcast media, along with the fact that this debate is, in fact, in front of an audience of over 900, many of whom are voters?
Well, Mr. Higgins first decided that we could debate here, I said, that's great, because I'll record it and put it on my website so that the public could hear the questions being asked and then both of the candidates answering them. When I received my rules for the debate, it said there will be no recording of it. So BEN said they normally record the whole thing and put it on their website. I assume that's not going to happen if there's no recording of it. So that the actual voters, and I know some of you are voters, the teachers are voters, and some of the seniors are 18 and able to vote, but actual voters in Western New York have not had the opportunity to show up somewhere and ask questions and hear the contrast. Now, the League of Women Voters this year decided not to cover our race, and at the last minute, 3 days before, I get a letter saying that so few people had responded in the Amherst Senior Center location that they asked if we could come. But they were changing the format so that the people there couldn't ask questions. So we each got 5 minutes, there were no questions asked, and then we went to private tables and they could ask us privately what their question was. So it has been absolutely tamped down, and that is why that commercial ran, because I would like to have an open debate where anybody could come and ask questions.
Thank you. Congressman Higgins, your rebuttal.
Yeah, I'm pleased to participate in this debate. I didn't decide to do it. I was invited. Like my opponent was, and decided to participate. I also participated in 5 candidate forums over the last 2 weeks, 2 of which my opponent was not there. And at the outset, it was explained that she was invited and didn't respond. This is a debate. This is a great debate. There are a lot of people here, and I think we should continue the debate at the debate.
Thank you. Our next direct question will go to Mr. Higgins.
Congressman Higgins. After a New York doctor who had treated Ebola patients in Guinea tested positive for the disease himself, upon his return to New York City, our Governor Andrew Cuomo and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie jointly announced a mandatory 21-day quarantine period for anyone returning to those states from an Ebola-afflicted country. Both have since walked that policy back to some degree, largely at the urging of the White House. Should the United States adopt a national policy regarding travel to and from Ebola-afflicted nations, possibly even including mandatory quarantines?
With respect to Ebola, it's a very serious problem. It's multidimensional in terms of its root cause. West Africa, Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia are places that have sanitation systems that we could not comprehend, or lack of sanitation systems that we cannot comprehend. I think the best thing for our country to do is listen to public health officials, not politicians, on this issue. Politicians have a responsibility to hold the government accountable. In Congress, We have what's referred to as oversight responsibility. We also have budgetary responsibility. And we have a Center for Disease Control and Prevention. That's the name of it. And it would seem to me that that would be the agency from which we would trust the professionals, public health officials, to advise us and the individual hospitals that have to have preparedness centers to take Ebola potentially infected individuals. So I think listening less to the political folks and listening more to the public health community is probably in our best interest with respect to this.
Thank you. Mrs. Wepner, your rebuttal.
We are responding to many things today politically instead of medically, especially, I think, with Ebola. The CDC has spent 6% of its $3 billion over the last few years on silly studies instead and painting bike pictures on streets and farmers' markets. Only 6% has been spent on epidemiology and labs. And, you know, we've studied things such as, you know, if you combine an energy drink and alcohol, will it make you want to have sex? If, you know, why lesbians are fat? Over $600,000 on silly studies instead of on infectious diseases. And we've been squandering the money that we do have. So I believe, yes, there should be a quarantine. And they're quarantining our soldiers in Germany for 21 days.
Thank you, Mrs. Yep. Wepner. Our next direct question to Mrs. Wepner.
Mrs. Wepner, this year alone there have been 7 different people who have scaled the White House fences. Most recently, one man was able to enter the White House while armed with a knife and handguns in his vehicle. The trespasser was eventually taken down by an off-duty Secret Service man and apprehended by federal authorities. Nonetheless, this consistent breach of White House security causes many to wonder how safe our federal buildings really are within the nation's capital. Do you believe that the federal buildings in Washington, D.C., such as Capitol Hill and the White House, are thoroughly secured, or can the government do more to ensure the safety of these buildings and the public officials that work within them?
I think our federal buildings have to be open to the public. They're our buildings. We paid for them. The representatives that represent us are there, and there has to be access. As far as the White House, you know, the Secret Service, from what I've heard, they protect the people in the White House. So does there have to be maybe a different security force that just protects the building? I had always thought that you know, the building was protected by the Secret Service, but it's not so. I think Secret Service should be, you know, always on its toes, but I don't think our federal buildings at all should be blocked off to us. We should have free access to them. And as long as I think our public officials should be able to be armed, I really do, and they can't in Washington. In fact, I can be armed here, and I have to leave my firearm at home if I go to Washington. How terrible that is. How really terrible that is, because my protection it should be my responsibility. Because that's what my Constitution says I can do. And I think those laws have to change so that our buildings can remain open.
Thank you. Congressman Higgins, your rebuttal.
There's a Capitol Hill police force. They're highly professional, well-trained. Some have died in the line of duty. Throughout our history, we will always have violence. People will choose to do harm to our nation's capital and the people that work there, be they in the White House or in the Capitol. But I do believe that the public should have as much access to the Capitol as possible. That said, I do think that certain security measures should be taken, and they are, and it inconveniences people. You know, you get to the Capitol buildings early in the morning, there's a big line out in front. And these are all workers who have to go through, you know, the screening and everything. And it's a burden, but, you know, it's also the reality of the post-9/11 era. And there's certain inconvenience, and unfortunately some of our civil rights are compromised because of it, unfortunately.
Thank you. Our next direct question to Congressman Higgins.
Congressman Higgins, with last week's terrorist attack at Ottawa's Parliament Hill and the reports last month that terrorists might be planning attacks on the New York City subway, it seems the terrorist threat to the United States and our allies is real and ongoing. What should and can be done to protect the homeland and its borders from those who seek to do us harm, while not excluding those who are simply trying to improve their state and life?
Very good question. We live on the northern border. Southern Ontario is a big part of the Western New York economy. We want to, as much as possible, promote the unrestricted movement of goods and services and people that are constructive and not wanting to do harm to other people in and out of Western New York. Unfortunately, there's an element that would want to do harm to us. Toronto is an international city. We have the Niagara Power Project, which I spoke of before. The Peace Bridge is the second busiest northern border crossing between the United States and Canada. Why do I mention these? Because these are high-impact targets that are potential terrorist targets. But the collaboration between United States and Canadian law enforcement officials to thwart terrorist activity before it's executed should be the goal. And that occurred earlier last year. There was a plot to blow up a passenger train that was moving between Toronto and New York City. Two of the suspects that were apprehended were Al-Qaeda affiliates. But the good thing is, that plot was stopped before it could be executed. And so it's a continuation of increased border protection. We will have 100 new Customs and Border Protection agents assigned to the Western New York bridges next year.
Thank you. Your rebuttal?
The soldier in Canada that lost his life had no bullets in his gun. What a shame. Maybe he would have been able to fight back. The sergeant-at-arms that ended it had a firearm, and he came out and ended it because he was a good guy with a gun. Our southern border in the last year has had 500,000 people stream across it, 40% of who we don't know who they are. The rising threat is ISIL, a murderous criminal organization that is rampaging across the Middle East, who has said they won't stop until their flag is flying over our White House. We have done nothing for border security at all, and this just continues. We have to get a handle on who these people are and be able to do something about them.
Thank you. Our next direct question to Mrs. Wepner.
Mrs. Wepner, it has been publicly stated that you are adamantly opposed to the New York State Common Core educational standards. In fact, you have written that Common Core has an open disrespect for parents and must be stopped. What in particular do you oppose within the Common Core criteria, and what changes would you advise state educators to make in order to improve the quality of education in the future?
Educators have always known that if there was a parent or someone at home that opened up that backpack when the child got home, that child had an advantage. That they had a parent that could help with homework, that could make sure it was done, that could answer questions. That's what Common Core has taken away. And people have approached me all summer. I just logged my 300th event, and the thought that there would be a candidate forum that I would miss is ridiculous. I must not have been invited. But parents have come up to me and said, you know, I have an engineering degree and a physics degree, and I can't help my first grader with his homework. If I help my first grader with their math homework, they will get it wrong. I've had parents that have gone on and tried to learn Common Core math themselves so they can help their child, because 2 + 2 doesn't equal 4 anymore. It is, and NewYorkState.gov has some tutorials that will blow your mind, because I went to them, and by fifth grade, I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe it's so convoluted. So we've changed the curriculum to such a drastic degree that parents can't even help their kids with their homework anymore. So what does that do? This little first grader now knows mom's not smart enough to help him with his math homework, and only his teacher can help him.
Thank you. Congressman Higgins, your rebuttal?
National standards are important, particularly when you look at, you know, an interconnected global economy. But the implementation of Common Core, I think, has been less than optimal. At any center of an educational system is the teacher. And too frequently, policy is made without the input of teachers. It's administrators, it's politicians, but at the heart of an educational system is a teacher. My wife's a Buffalo Public School teacher. The time put into you know, correcting papers and testing, I think, takes away from the real goal of education and what the Christian Brothers try to instill in all of you with this institution. And that's building the whole individual to be a public servant, to be...
Thank you. Thank you, Congressman Higgins. Our next direct question will go to the congressman.
Congressman Higgins, in 2010, you voted for the president's signature legislation, the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah.
While it has withstood all manner of attempted recalls and Supreme Court challenges and has achieved some of its stated goals, its rollout has been less than perfect. With everything from website crashes to the refusal of multiple states to create their own exchanges, do you believe the legislation has been successful so far, and are there aspects of the law that you would change if you could?
I did support it, proudly. The rollout was a disaster. Many mistakes have been made. For the past 100 years, both Democratic and Republican administrations in Washington have tried to institute health care reform. Why? It's a $2.5 trillion industry. It represents 18% of the American economy. But health care costs were growing at a rate of 10, 12, 14% a year. Not sustainable. That's why people lose their health care. 1 million people a year file for bankruptcy because of health care debt, and they had insurance. So the focus of the Affordable Care Act is to contain the growth of health care and include more people, because the uninsured end up in hospital emergency rooms anyhow, which is the most expensive care to administer, and they end up there when they're sicker than they otherwise would be. We can get health care reform straight, but Congress voted last year 55 times to repeal the bill. I am prepared. I am prepared to consider constructive amendments toward the goal of making health care reform work for all Americans.
Thank you. Your rebuttal?
137,000 Western New Yorkers had their policies canceled, people that had been taking care of themselves. We have deductibles now that are so high, people can't get surgery until they get $5,000 sitting in their bank account that they can go and pay for, so their new insurance policy will kick in. Spouses have been canceled so that the mandates can be reached. The health care law, which Brian voted for and has subjected us all to, I read the whole thing, and it took me 6 months to follow all the rabbit trails that it goes down connecting the IRS and Social Security and Medicare law. This bill gutted Medicare of $716 billion. By 2017, it is estimated by the CBO that 75% of all home health care agencies will be out of business. And those agencies help our seniors.
Thank you. Our next direct question to Mrs. Wepner.
Mrs. Wepner, over the last decade, several U.S. states have turned towards legalizing marijuana for medical purposes, such as dealing with chronic physical pain and terminal illnesses. Do you believe New York State should follow in this trend and legalize medical marijuana? And if so, under what conditions?
The main reason why I don't think we should legalize marijuana is it kills ambition. And we need ambition in this country. It's what built our country. Now, we give patients morphine in the hospital when they've had surgery and they're in pain. We use OxyContin. These are all opiate drugs. But we don't sell opiates at 7-Eleven. If there are medicinal purposes that marijuana can be used for, then we need to study it. Do you know there haven't been medical studies saying that it is even effective in any disorders? We wouldn't put a medicine on the market without studying it. And if there are properties that help seizure disorders, then we need to study what properties those are, put them in a little inhaler. We can't open pot stores. That would be terrible for your futures. It really would. We need clear-thinking young people to attack the problems we have, not people that are going to sit back with a bag of Doritos and watch television. Okay? We need you guys on the ball. That's what we need. There we go.
Thank you. Congressman Higgins, your rebuttal.
Yeah, just let me, Ms. Wepner said that the health care bill gutted $700 billion from the Medicare bill. That $700 billion is both in the Democratic and Republican budgets. What it does over 7 years, it cuts the growth of Medicare, saving the program $700 billion. So it wasn't cut. It projects savings over a decade of $700 billion. Again, I think that the decisions about marijuana use for medicinal purposes is a medical issue that should be decided by people in that profession relative to their efficacy. And if there are people out there suffering and the medical use of marijuana can help, that should certainly be considered.
Thank you. Our next direct question to Congressman Higgins.
Congressman Higgins, dysfunctional is one of the milder terms critics use to describe the 113th Congress. A recent NBC Wall Street Journal poll shows Congress's approval rating at 12%. Despite this, the reelection rate for Congress in 2012 general election was over 90% in both the House and the Senate. The 22nd Amendment, ratified in 1951, limits the time a president can hold office. As a means to help break through congressional gridlock, would you support a constitutional amendment establishing term limits for members of Congress?
I do not support term limits, and I never have. I think that we run every 2 years. People certainly have the opportunity to exercise their right to vote, and they should. They should become informed about the candidates that are here, and that's why forums like this are being held. There are some very, very good members of Congress, and there are some that are not very good. Term limits won't really change that. I think being able to discern the good ones from the bad ones is what we should be doing, and that's what elections are all about. So I'm, you know, my record's out there. You know, I've tried to do a lot of things for this community. I have a voting record, and I suspect that people will review that before making a decision as to whether or not I should be reelected, and I'm good with that.
Thank you. Your rebuttal?
10,000 baby boomers are retiring daily, so our senior population is growing. So if you don't grow with it in the budget, it will not end up well for them. I have signed a pledge for term limits. Because of the gerrymandering of the districts done by politicians, they rarely get fired from office just because of the numbers. This district is a D+14. Democrats have a 14% advantage. If you live in this district, chances are you're a Democrat, and your parents are Democrats. I have signed a term limits limiting congressional House of Representatives to 3 terms, which would be 6 years, and the Senate to 2 terms. I think we need more people that have gone through and publicly served, not less people.
Thank you. Our next direct question will be to Mrs. Wepner.
Mrs. Wepner, since 9/11, the United States government has taken drastic measures to fight the war on terrorism. Some of these measures have included specific torture tactics such as waterboarding and sleep deprivation, which have knowingly occurred in the U.S. military base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. What, if any, do you consider justified and legal torture when interrogating potential terrorists, and do you believe that the United States should continue to use such tactics in the future?
I think it would be so great if both sides could agree not to do that. I have a couple kids that are Marines, a son and a daughter, that one's currently serving and one just got out. And it would be awful for them to get, captured and waterboarded or had sleep deprivation. But those two things are not going to kill them. And I know in the few times that they are used, they get valuable information. And I don't think people, die regularly of sleep deprivations. You guys are teenagers. You probably go through that, somewhat on weekends sometimes. But I don't think sleep deprivation or waterboarding is something, if we are going to get valuable information that can save lives, is a horrible thing. I really don't. So, if we're, cutting people up and killing them, that would be awful. And the few times that has happened, we have prosecuted those cases. But sleep deprivation isn't gonna kill anyone.
Thank you. Your rebuttal, Congressman?
Torture should not be tolerated in any context or any part of the world.
That's it.
Oh, okay, thank you. Our next direct question to the congressman.
Congressman Higgins, with the purchase of the Buffalo Bills by Buffalo Sabres owner Terry Pegula, it seems the team's tenure in Buffalo is, thankfully, secure for a long time to come. Since the sale, there has been renewed talk about the construction of a new stadium in the city proper. Would you lend support to the building of a new stadium somewhere in downtown Buffalo? And if we built a new stadium, Would you support the use of at least some public funding?
I would support the construction of a new stadium in downtown Buffalo. Fact of the matter is 75% of all stadium construction is funded by the public. That's a problem. That's a problem. Teams are making a lot of money. The league's making a lot of money. And taxpayers shouldn't be subsidizing stadium construction at that level. That said, Kim and Terry Pegula have made a huge contribution to this community. They have energized this community, securing the Buffalo Bills' viability here for a long time. And I think we will do, the public community and the private community, whatever it is we can do to make them successful. The good thing is there's a new 10-year lease, and there are many, many years left on it. So let's enjoy the stadium that we have, the team that we have. Hopefully they can continue the winning streak or start a winning streak and be successful moving forward. But there's a lot of reasons that contribute to the viability of a team. You know, often people say, you know, let's build a new stadium to keep the Bills here. I say let's build a new Peace Bridge to keep the Bills here, because a lot of the ticket buying base for both the Sabres and the Bills is Southern Ontario.
Thank you. Your rebuttal?
I think a new stadium downtown would be fantastic. You know, when we went through the expansion teams, North Carolina, when they built their stadium, their season ticket holders bought the seats. I think they paid $5,000 a piece for them, or I remember it was quite a while ago. But I think there are creative ways for stadiums to be built that don't have to include public dollars. For a country that's $18 trillion in debt, we have to look at all non-essential spending. We really and truly do. Our interest last year on our debt was $500 billion. It's why interest rates are being kept at near zero. We really have to look at the important things.
Thank you. We'll ask one more direct question to each candidate with their rebuttals, and then we will begin the closing statements. Your last direct question, Mrs. Wepner.
Mrs. Wepner, currently the national minimum wage is $7.50. The goal of raising the minimum wage is to keep people from falling below the poverty threshold based on modern standards of living. President Barack Obama has recently suggested raising the national minimum wage to over $10 per hour. Do you support this minimum wage increase recommended to Congress by the president?
Well, why make it 15? Let's have everybody get 30 bucks an hour. Okay. So, now, that doesn't make any sense. If you just say everybody gets 30 bucks an hour, what does it do to a person that's currently making 20 bucks an hour, who's been at his job several years and has gotten promotions? Minimum, you know, the wages have to go up and down with market forces, or it doesn't work. It just doesn't. The minimum wage being raised to $15 an hour, please go on my website, wepnerforcongress.com. I have a minimum wage. There's a huge report there that I put together. It hurts the poor the most. It will cut another 500,000 jobs out of the economy if we do this. And if we do it now, it will be devastating, because the jobs that we are creating, and please go to my website and look at the jobs in the economy and Obamacare on the effect of jobs in the economy, because we really didn't get to those kinds of questions today. We really have to do things that will help the economy. The corporate tax rates have to be cut in half so our companies stop leaving. Our corporate tax rates are at 39%. The rest of the world is 22%. Minimum wage has to go up and down with the market.
Thank you. Your rebuttal, Congressman.
Since the enactment of the Affordable Care Act, 10 million private sector jobs were created in this country. 17,000 were created right here in Western New York. The minimum wage should be raised, because what that would do is create more demand in the economy. And when people have money, they spend it. And when people buy things, people make things. When people make things, people work. When people work, they're productive. This is not a radical proposal. If, when first enacted, the minimum wage was indexed to inflation to retain its value throughout the years, it would have been approximately what the president is proposing. So I believe that an increase in the minimum wage would be helpful to economic growth in this country.
Thank you. And our last direct question will be to Congressman Higgins.
Congressman Higgins, the United States seems to be flirting with engaging in another large-scale conflict in Iraq, this time to bolster an Iraqi military that has so far had limited success in combating the threat to the Middle East stability and human decency posed by the terrorist group calling itself the Islamic State, or ISIL. The president's current policy of targeted airstrikes has drawn criticism from hawks who say it's too little, too late, as well as doves who say this is not our war to fight. Congressman, what should we do about ISIL?
They should be destroyed. And the 11 countries of the Arab League have to participate. The 194 countries in this world have to participate beyond saying to the United States, we support you just as long as we don't have to do anything. You know, we just spent $1 trillion in Iraq. You just spent $26 billion training an Iraqi army. ISIS came after them. They ran. The United States military did their job in Iraq. The best thing that we could do, based on any objective analysis, was to tamp down violence, to allow the Sunni, Shia, and Kurd population to achieve political reconciliation. Nuri al-Maliki, the former prime minister of Iraq, failed miserably. He kept the Sunnis out, and unless and until in that part of the world, minority rights are respected, you're never going to have peace. Look, in America, we fought a civil war. We were a nation of 30 million people. 650,000 people died. If people can't resolve their differences peacefully, unfortunately, war is a consequence of the inability to achieve political reconciliation.
Thank you. Your rebuttal?
Mr. Higgins sits on four committees that heard testimony over the last year and a half, 2 years, about the threat of ISIL and the rising threat and the global threat and to our homeland. And when the Iraqis were begging for Apache helicopters because ISIL was lined up on the Syrian-Iraqi border, Mr. Higgins' committee held it up and did not give him the Apache helicopters that they needed to get them from the air. We let them come over into Iraq because we did nothing, sleeping at the wheel on these committees. We did nothing. They went village after village after village, and once Baghdad was completely surrounded, then we decided we were sending a few hundred people, advisors there. After they went village to village, now they have our MRAPs and armed tanks, and they're fighting us with our stuff. Absolutely a terrible mismanagement of things.
Thank you. Based on the earlier coin toss, Mrs. Wettner will go first with her closing statement. Each candidate will be given 2.5 minutes, followed by Congressman Higgins. Mrs. Wettner.
We have, since 2007, increased our population by 17.1 million. We have 347,000 fewer jobs than in 2007. We are 10 million jobs short of where we should be in growing our economy. And 71% of small businesses say that it is the Obamacare legislation that is doing it. We must fix this. The only way out of our debt is jobs, getting America back to work. We have spent four generations throwing money at people, telling them, stay home. You have nothing to offer America. And that just isn't true. Everybody brings valuable things to the table. We must reverse this trend. More people are going on public assistance, not able to climb out of it, not being able to have an American dream. There's nowhere to go if you don't have a job, if you get up every morning and you don't have a purpose and you can't be productive. We need to get our jobs back that have left to other countries. We need to do this immediately. We need to be able to have you get out of college or if you want to graduate from high school and get a job, you should be able to do that. America used to be a place that you could do that. 44% of college graduates right now are underemployed. They're working part-time because that's the kind of jobs this economy, because of this legislation, has produced part-time workers. And part-time work won't pay your student loan debt back. Part-time work doesn't feed families. We need full-time jobs being created in this country. And government doesn't create jobs. Government writes policies that are job-friendly. And having corporate tax rates at 39.1%, when the rest of the world is at 22%, is not job-friendly. And we need all kinds of jobs. We need $10 jobs and $12 jobs and $14 and $16. We need all the jobs. You know, I talked to a gentleman at the Midway Memorial, and he had stormed the beaches of Normandy that day when so many had died. And I asked him, how did that happen? How did you survive and thousands get killed? And he said he had hauled concrete on his back, 50-pound sacks since the age of 12, and maybe he was just stronger. We need all the strengths and all the talents of all Americans to get on deck and help us recover from this debt.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Wepner. Congressman Higgins?
In the past 5 years, 10 million private sector jobs have been added to the economy. We've had 55 months of consecutive job growth, and it's not enough. We spent about $2 trillion in Iraq and Afghanistan rebuilding the roads and bridges. We lost a lot of American lives. Those places are as chaotic and corrupt as they were the day that we went in there. What is the lesson to us? The lesson is we need to nation build, not in Iraq, not in Afghanistan, but at home in America. We need to invest in Americans, in education, in scientific research, in infrastructure. You just spent $89 billion rebuilding the roads and bridges of Afghanistan. You just spent $76 billion rebuilding the roads and bridges of Iraq. And all Congress could come up with was $50 billion to rebuild the roads and bridges of America that are falling apart. There are 99 structurally deficient bridges right here in Western New York. Every second of every day, 7 cars drive on a bridge that is structurally deficient. It has a material impact on the performance of our economy. We have learned, you know, my opponent talks about debt and deficit, and she's right, that's a big problem. But in the 1990s, we had a budgetary surplus of $258 billion because we created 22 million private sector jobs. The best tax policy is not right or left, it's the policy that puts people back to work and makes them productive, less dependent on government, more independent and self-sufficient. But it's a different world today because of globalization, because of information technology. Everybody can plug in and play economically. Tom Friedman, the world is flat. So what does that say to America? We have to educate our people up to and beyond the current technology. But you can't do that without making investments in the system. You can't do that without being in a continuous improvement mode. Whatever you're doing today, you have to figure out how you do it more efficiently and effectively tomorrow. America has been the greatest public-private partnership in the history of the world. We have a lot of problems, without question. But we are still the country that people look to all over the world who take in immigrants legally, more than every country in the world combined, because we do it right. And we've done it throughout our history, and it's made our economy strong and resilient. Thank you very much. Thank you.